Hello and welcome to the Monster Mechanics Podcast, where we take creatures of myth and media and see how they can be improved. I am your host, Scott Paladin, and with me as always is the Pumbaa to my Timon, Zach Jakeways. What are we talking about today, Zach?
This week we're discussing the Minotaur.
So the Minotaur, the famous Greek legend of the man with a bull's head, basically. That's the most salient details about it. The legend actually comes... It's about a civilization that existed on Crete, but it's the Greeks talking about them. So it's all kinds of inflammatory and inaccurate. But the original legend is that there was a Minoan king, King Minos, who very much would like to have... He wasn't king yet. He needed to show his worth. And so he prayed to Poseidon and asked Poseidon to help him out. So Poseidon sent him a beautiful white bull out of the ocean.
That's where bulls come from, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, like, if you're gonna get a bull from Poseidon, it would be weird if it came from like the land, right? Like, it's got to come out of the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's on brand for him.
And Poseidon says, okay, you can have this bull, that'll prove your worth, and then what you got to do is when you've become king, you need to sacrifice this beautiful bull back to me as a sacrifice. And Minos is like, this is awesome, I'll totally do that. Then he becomes king and naturally says, nope, never mind, I'd like to have the bull, I'd like to eat have my bull and eat it too, I guess. And he instead sacrifices an imposter bull, and Poseidon, to punish the king's hubris, has the king's wife fall in love with the bull. And then the wife has Daedalus, the great inventor of ancient Greece, make her a hollow cow so that she can get inside of it. And we're going to leave the rest of that to people's imaginations or not, as your own choice. And eventually she gives birth to the Minotaur, which is a little as a man with a bull's head on top of him. For some reason, there is an explanation given in the actual legend, but I think it's bull crap, which is, yes, that was intentional. Anyway, but for some reason, the Minotaur has to eat human flesh to sustain himself. And so King Minos imprisons the bull in a labyrinth that he just conveniently happens to have underneath the underneath the palace. And every 7 years, he sacrifices like 14 children from Athens to the bull, who eats them until eventually Theseus comes along and there's a whole thing, and the bull and the Minotaur ends up dead. And anyway, we're not concerned with most of that. We have some questions, though, that we need to answer.
Just kind of a quick aside, like one of the interesting things, whenever we talk about like a labyrinth and whatnot, there's always kind of like, I think like the modern take on a labyrinth is always like just kind of a maze or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But in that case, like the labyrinth was just like a continuous loop, I think.
Yeah, or the spiral. Symbol. Yeah, yeah. The whether or not that is the labyrinth of the myth is, you know, debatable, but there's definitely a labyrinth symbol that shows up in Greek art, and it is, yeah, there's no branches in it at all. It is just a long, long passage. It would be impossible to get lost in, which is strange. I agree with you. I'm not sure what the deal is there. We could ask somebody who has a bit more knowledge than me.
I think that actually kind of makes like being chased by the Minotaur like all the more terrifying, because there's no hiding from it.
That's true. So the first question that came to mind when I brought up the Minotaur to you online the other day was, why the heck is it carnivorous?
Like, yeah.
There's an explanation from the legend, which is that because it is neither man nor beast, it has no place in the natural world, and therefore can only sustain itself by eating humans, which I don't buy that at all. That particular explanation doesn't hold any water to me. Like, humans are just a kind of animal. And so if it's half human, half bovine, then it should either have like human teeth that can chew. You know, we're omnivorous, so we've got incisors and molars and canines and all that stuff for eating a bunch of different varieties of foods. Or it needs to have cow guts inside of it so that it can process the grass that a cow would normally eat, because that's what a cow's teeth are built for. And so either it's not going to be able to chew the food properly for the guts that it has, or it's not going to be able to digest the food properly for the food that it can eat. So there's got to be an explanation for there. We can play around with that a little space.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing that springs to my mind is, I mean, maybe that's the only food source he's got in there. Like, if there's no vegetation or anything growing in the labyrinth and he's just being sacrificed, you know, you eat what you got.
I guess, except if you're King Minos in this situation, which is easier to get? Children from a Greek country, like over the across the sea from you, to get humans, or just some grass that you can grow on your own island? Like, surely that would be an easier solution, is to like feed him nuts and berries and olives and stuff. Like, that can't be the simplest solution. Now, I will say, before anybody else who happens to know this fact is screaming at their podcatcher, I say that bovines are herbivorous. I've said that they eat plants. They will opportunistically eat animals and flesh. I have seen video of a cow eat a baby chick. It's exactly what you would. It's as horrifying as you might describe. It's not on accident. It's doing it purposefully, especially when they're in a situation where they're lacking mineral content that they need. When they have some sort of deficiency, they will definitely opportunistically prey on other animals. But that's really not what they're built to do, as it were. Like, they're not good at it the same way that an obligate carnivore might. Now, we brought this up, and you know what would be much scarier than a man with a cow's head is pig head. Like, pigs will eat anything.
Oh yeah,
Given the opportunity, a pig will happily eat you. Like, pigs are pleased as punch to eat any kind of flesh or berries and nuts and mushrooms and any kinds of crap that's laying around.
They are nature's trash compactor.
I mean, that's why we ended up domesticating them. Them along with goats are just like, they'll eat the stuff that we have left over. And so therefore it's pretty easy to keep a pig around eating your leftover crap. And then when, you know, in the winter time, you can slaughter one of your pigs and have some nice salt pork to get you through the winter. But yeah. And then if you've ever seen a wild boar up close, those dudes are scary as crap. Like,
oh yeah,
big old tusks and wiry hair. And like, they're also a terrible scourge. I don't know if we've talked about the plague of wild boars through America at this point, but like, they are smart and dangerous. Like, they will kill, they won't hunt down like full grown animals, but they will totally eat the young of other prey animals, young deer and stuff. They reproduce at an incredible rate. Like, there's a real problem with trying to get rid of pigs in the South, in the American South right now.
Like, I know you'll see like herds of, you know, 30 to hundreds of them down here.
Yeah. 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 And they're smart too. I fell down a YouTube rabbit hole once of looking up like people who try to eliminate wild hogs. And they build these big old traps where they have to build them with an entrance on two sides. It has to have two entrances and exits because the pigs are too smart to go into a cutoff. So they have to be able to see all the way through it before they'll even go inside. And then they have to wait until all of them are inside of this pen before they close the doors, and then they're trapped. Because if they let any of them get away, those pigs are smart enough and they will never get caught in that trap again. Like, a single time is enough for them to go, nope, never doing that. And they will produce like, you know, 4 or 5 litters a year or something like that. Like, you have to kill 90% of them just to maintain the population at its current rate, to keep them from growing. They're like a huge scourge. So the minnow pig, the pig of Minos, would be, I think, arguably scarier than the bull.
Yeah, I think that's definitely. Like, and that's just a horrifying visual too. Just
pigs are ugly.
Just squealing and screaming as it's come charging after you down through the labyrinth.
Yeah. And that pink pig skin really blends well with like the human skin. Like, ugh. You could totally imagine that him having that kind of pink pig skin texture all over.
Just like a row of like sow's nipples just all the way down.
Oh yeah, and the like that bristly fur down the back. Yeah, that's gross. Yeah. Now, the reason why that it's the bull is because the actual culture of Minos, or sorry, the actual culture of Greek at the time, we call them the Minoans, based off of this legend, although we don't know what they call themselves because we don't understand their language. But we do have a bunch of their art. A bunch of the ancient Minoan art survives, and they loved bulls. Like, this culture absolutely adored bulls in their art and in symbolism, and probably in their religion too. Again, we don't know that for sure, but there are hundreds and hundreds of mosaics and paintings of people leaping over bulls. It seemed to be some sort of sport or game.
Interesting. the original rodeo, perhaps?
Yeah, basically, yeah, rodeo clown style. They would like have a bull charge them and then I guess grab its horns and push themselves over the top of it like a hurdle.
Interesting.
And so it's pretty easy to see how the ancient Greeks would have seen, like, looked at these people's art and talked to them and been like, you know what, you guys love bulls, and then have that leak into their legends about these people. It's very
interesting. Yeah, look back and see sort of like a reductivist take on another culture through the eyes of a culture that we've kind of reduced down to a lot of myth and
Now there is definitely something to sort of the heart of that legend, which is like the in this case, the king, although you could have it be sort of the culture at large, who sort of commits a sin and then that lives underneath the country and is something that they have to pay for. I do like that aspect of it, which this idea of like, we did something wrong. We broke some sort of divine rule, pissed off a god. And now every so many years we have to pay in terms of blood. And you could imagine that originally that was their own children. And it was only through like imperialism and conquest that they went out and gathered the young of other countries. Mm-hmm. So let's start digging down into this. Do we want to stick with the bull, or do we want to switch our Minotaur out for a pig man?
I also like the idea that maybe like the carnivorous nature is maybe also just like a function of the labyrinth. Like maybe there's something special about the labyrinth itself.
Ooh. So wait, what if the labyrinth comes first? Mm-hmm. So you're talking about it being the function of a labyrinth. So like you make the labyrinth first, or the labyrinth occurs in your country underneath the ground, and labyrinths either attract or create the monsters inside.
Yeah. Like there needs to be like a dragon at the helm or something, like some sort of creature that's embodies the terror of the labyrinth.
So, what is it? Okay, so then what causes the labyrinth? Is the labyrinth naturally forming, or is it is it the remains of mines that the country like carved out the bones of the very nation to like gain minerals or something? Or is the labyrinth a manifestation of anxiety or their own sins or something?
Oh gosh, like the thing that always comes to mind is Spirals by Junji Ito. Just like that sort of naturally occurring metaphysical spirals.
Yeah. I do like the idea that it's something about the people living in this country that creates the labyrinth. And so maybe the labyrinth isn't in this sense isn't a physical place, but is maybe the wall between the reality, our reality, the reality of humans, and the place of the labyrinth is thin in this area. Okay. And that something about the way these people act or comport themselves or something, or maybe something about their rituals maybe wears it thinner and occasionally opens up the holes to the labyrinth and opens up ways into this maze-like area.
Okay.
I do like the idea that it's got to be some sort of like, I think it's got to be something like, I like the word, I keep coming back to the word sin. It's got to be some sort of like transgression they keep committing. Let's see. Okay, let's pull one from history, which is that lots and lots of especially Near East cultures were like sort of the proto-Indo-European cultures, the ones that came from the Near East. There's a huge emphasis put on hospitality. This is really wide ranging across a lot of different cultures too. It's not just these, but the idea that like if somebody shows up to your house and says, "Hey, I need shelter for the night," and you agree to bring them in, that like they are sacrosanct. That is a bond that you cannot break for fear of it causing all kinds of problems for you. It's like it's one of the biggest sins, right? Like to kill a man isn't that big a deal, but to kill a guest, huge deal.
Yeah.
So if we can imagine a world where like that is, maybe that's important. Like maybe that is actually an important thing. Like being lost out in the night is how you end up in the labyrinth, right? And so like letting people in and like holding them, keeping them safe from the terrors of the night is important. And breaking that, like as a culture, like if this entire area for a while just said, screw that. No, we're not going to let people in, or we're going to let them in and kill, you know, kill them and take their goods or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that like the entire country is like still paying for these crimes in the past.
Ooh, where they, I like that.
Yeah. Where they like as a broad group, or maybe like in sort of part of their foundational myth or something like that, this happened. And they like said to themselves, this is not important to us anymore.
Like maybe it was something, maybe it's like a natural disaster, like a plague or disease or something where it became dangerous to let in things.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Okay. So yeah.
The labyrinth doesn't care about that.
Yeah, yeah. They responded to a very in a very natural human way. They said, we're no longer going to honor this this compact of letting people in because of a plague. That's a great that's a fantastic idea. And in response to that disaster, they end up with a second order disaster of like the labyrinth coming home, basically. Mm-hmm. And like being all the more prevalent in their country. And maybe even like so like maybe one of the rules is if you have a hearth. You know, if you have a threshold, right, mm-hmm. in your home, you know, you've built a home in an area, and that is an area in which the labyrinth can't manifest.
Okay. Like,
there are no entrances to labyrinths inside of homes.
But by doing so, you agree to an unspoken contract.
Yes. And if you let somebody in or like you refuse somebody who needs help, and like keep them out of your threshold, then you weaken that threshold. Hmm. And you do that enough times, and then suddenly one day you could open your closet door and it could be an entrance into the labyrinth.
Okay, I like that.
Or open your front door, you know, like you're trying to leave your home and you open it and it's just a cave on the other side.
Oh, I love the idea that like you're just trapped in there now because like you're just now a part of the labyrinth because it's you've abandoned your claim to you know, mm-hmm. be apart from the labyrinth.
Right. Yeah, like the only way that humanity maintains like safety from this other reality, you know, is by agreeing all to help each other. And that it is that compact, that contract that keeps everybody safe. And if you violate it, even for a really good reason, you know, you have a whole population of people who come through with a disease that you will also harm you, and you refuse them all, like it weakens those bonds to the point where that thing starts to prey on you. Okay, cool. I love that. Okay, so we've got sort of a rough idea of how the labyrinth happens. And we're saying that like, okay, so here's the question. Does the labyrinth attract minotaurs or does it create minotaurs?
I like creating them personally.
Okay. I think that's the right realm for us as well. So the labyrinth is like this, it's a dimension unto itself, right? Like it's entirely an M.C. Escher painting, right? Like if we want to draw in the art of M.C. Escher, who, if anyone's unfamiliar, was a draftsman who created these beautiful artworks. A lot of them, he would deal with fractals and tessellations and things like that, but also he would draw these lovely, physically impossible landscapes. Yeah. Things were like, if you've ever seen an image of a set of stairs that constantly go up, like they're coming around a rectangular structure, and they're always going up to the point where when it comes back to meet itself, it's still somehow going up because of a change in perspective and the way that he drew it. Mm-hmm. Lovely. There's also probably the most famous one is where you have it's a world where there is no down. Like there's all these different directions in which you might have stairs and doorways and passages and things like this. And the way they intersect with one another, you can't tell which way perspective would be going and tell which way the world is oriented. And in fact, he's got little figures drawn upside down and at right angles to each other. Lovely. Yeah, totally recommend looking that up.
I remember being a child and being just absolutely fascinated with those and trying to replicate so many of his drawings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So you can imagine a dimension that is like this, where like the laws of spatial relativity, basically, where they don't have to keep the same, they don't have to be consistent from place to place. In fact, you could go around, you know, you could be walking through a room, go around four corners, all going right, and not end up back where you were, right? Like these things could change and shift. In fact, a lot of that, to me, it reminds me also of the sort of dream architecture, where like, I'm sure everyone, you may or may not have experienced this, but I've certainly experienced like you go into a passage in a dream and it gets closer and closer as you are going along until the point where it's like you're rubbing shoulders and can't move forward or back. You know, Oof. This is like real things that can happen in the labyrinth, or like the idea of like you open a door, go through it, go back through the same door, but aren't where you were the first time. Like the idea that everything's going to shift and change around you is the realm of this labyrinth. So for saying that this dimension creates minotaurs, does it turn people into minotaurs, or does it like make, are they something else?
I was thinking like it turns people into minotaurs, and I think because this is sort of a realm apart, like, and the only people that end up there are actually people, that's the only food source. So maybe like that first act of cannibalism, when you finally encounter another person trapped in the labyrinth, is sort of the turning point for becoming a minotaur.
Okay. That's interesting. What if it, so we're this is a world where you can't rely on your own perceptions. Like it warps what you see and what you like I said, we're talking about like the landscape, the layout is always changing. So like you can't ever be completely sure what is true. And what if that extends itself to your perception of other people? So like when you encounter someone in the labyrinth, they may appear not human. And to them, you may appear not human.
Okay.
And so it heightens the original sin in that way, in that sense of like when you treat somebody who is human. So in that sense, it reflects the original sin that like when somebody comes to you asking for help and you treat them as though they're not worthy of help, like they're not human, then in the future, you cease to be able to see other people as human at all. And you see them either as monsters or as prey.
I like that.
Yeah. And so the minotaurs, like their form will be different. But it's always really just some other person. And you see them as some sort of horrible monster. And similarly, they see you as possibly they'd see you as like a I don't know why my brain goes to being like you're made of chocolate or candy or something like that. But that's where it went, where it's like you're just enticing. It's literally like when people get hungry in cartoons and one guy's head turns into a hamburger because the other guy's looking at it.
Yeah. Just they turn into that roast chicken.
Yep, exactly. As funny as that is, this is really literally what we're talking about. And so the exact form of the minotaur can vary from place to place. Maybe it would be a pig form. Maybe it would be a great like darkness or something like that, or even just like a disgusting human. You know, something that would be threatening. But it may prey on your own fears. But because you have already shown yourself to be, not incapable, but willing to see other people as different from you, then it also like, you just get that turned up to 11 and you get to live in a world where you cannot see humans for what they are.
Interesting. So unless you have more on this, I had another aspect I kind of wanted to touch on, which was like the myth of Theseus and defeating the Minotaur and like how he navigated the labyrinth.
So he was the actual original legend is that he travels to Minos and the daughter of the king, Ariadne, falls in love with Theseus and gives him a ball of yarn, if I remember correctly,
I believe
or something along those lines. It might be a magical ball of yarn, or maybe just might just be a simple one, hands it to him and says, here, this will help you find your way back. And then he goes in and he brings in his weapons and this ball of yarn and uses it to track his way. He goes in and he kills the Minotaur, which will save the country, I guess. This doesn't seem to be the correct answer to our current version of this legend, though. Like, this isn't, the Minotaur isn't something you could kill that way.
At this point, like, the labyrinth is almost like a sort of specialized hell or afterlife.
It absolutely is. I wonder if the answer is to, like, if I was writing this as a story, you have a character who ends up in the labyrinth and figures out what the issue is. Like at some point, like they, like the answer becomes like the way to get out of the labyrinth once you're in there is to see a monster as though it's human, right? Is to like to force yourself to have faith in other people, right? And to like treat them in, with the respect and humanity and empathy that humans deserve, and to take the risk, even like to face off and like to approach kindly to an actual monster, like, you know, like to go up to it, like to the Minotaur itself, and be like, no, I see that you are human and I am also human, and like we need to make this connection, and like reaching out and making that actual connection is probably the real answer to that. Rather than facing it with a sword. In our version of it, like Theseus would just kill somebody. Like he would just kill some dude.
Yeah.
And then possibly become a Minotaur himself, you know, or to be perceived as a Minotaur by someone else within his group.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to go with that. Like that there's an option for redemption in this.
Yeah. And then if you come out of that experience of having ended up in the labyrinth and found your way back out, then absolutely, you could imagine that person being very evangelical about like, no, you have to uphold the compact. You have to show kindness and empathy to those around you, or else you end up in the labyrinth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, like, geez, there's some big ass overtones of like symbolism over with this with our version of the labyrinth, and like it being about like loneliness or like isolation, or like the sort of tendency, like the othering quality of treating people like they're not of your own group, you know?
Yeah.
Which I like. That's cool. That'd be very powerful in the right way. So let's see. Is there anything else we want to attach to this idea?
I kind of like the idea of expanding more on the society that kind of leads to this labyrinth, and like, what is a society like that actually has all these, you know, beliefs that it's important to treat others, you know, like humans.
Yeah, I love the compact of like the importance of hospitality as your like one of your central ideas is like to bring, let other people come in and to keep them safe from the outside world. That's very cool. So you can see that sort of, the simplest like fantasy writer 101 version of world building is that all of these people are like sort of like hospitality innkeepers. Like they're always, you know, they might have things like lanterns outside their house that they have to keep lit in order to like guide travelers to their homes, you know? Are you familiar at all with the like the beliefs of the Sikhs?
Partly, not explicitly.
Yeah, I will not attest to be an expert, but one of the things I do know about them is that like these are the people who tend to wear be very stringent about wearing turbans. So like they're constantly fighting legal battles in order to be able to maintain their religious headgear. And they're actually also supposed to wear, if I remember correctly, they're supposed to have three things, which is, I'll get it wrong, but I know one of them is a dagger and one of them is a turban. And they actually talk about how those are symbols to the outside world saying, I am a Sikh and therefore you can come to me for help. Like one of their big philosophical imperatives, one of the things their religion tells them to do is help other people. And so I love the idea that might be something we could borrow a little bit of, that same idea of like the people of this culture, if they come out of this brush with the labyrinth with a lot of compassion towards other people, that they might find themselves acting as the same sort of beacons, you know?
Yeah.
Like publicly advertising themselves as people who are available for you to seek hospitality from and seek sanctuary with.
Interesting. I like the idea that maybe like their symbol of that might be like the Minotaur's horns or some sort of bull themed.
Yeah, they absolutely could choose something like that. The one thing that came to my mind was like a beacon or like a little lighthouse on all of their homes. Like they've got a little tower with they keep the light going inside to help people find their way. But I also like the bull as a symbol as well. Or maybe even sort of like I wonder if there's like something like a piece of equipment associated with cattle that they might, like we sort of traditionally associate cows as wearing bells around their necks sometimes. There's also the the septum piercing that's kind of associated with them as well. So there's that option. But I do like the idea of them borrowing traditional associations with it.
Getting that bovine energy.
Yeah. Unfortunately, not unlike horses and stuff, like, it's not like we ride them, so they have a little bit less gear and stuff associated with them. Because, like, in one sense, like, having them, like, for example, if they all, like, wore or carried with them bull horns, you know, actual cow horns, that seems to me, like, the symbolism of that is that they are recognizing maybe their own ability to see other people that way. Like, you're reminding yourself that we are all the Minotaur, you know? So you could make that work, but at the same time, it seems like I'm not entirely sure I like that as
the messaging seems a little wrong.
Yeah, it seems just slightly off. But I mean, for that matter, the balls of yarn might make sense, though. You know, where, like, they have the skeins, like,
as a guide.
Yeah, like, we're here to find you. No, I actually like the idea of they have the beacons, but maybe they also make paths to help people find their way. Like, they are the ones who will literally, like, through the forest, they will have a rope going from tree to tree that's been, like, tied off or, like, going through hooks or something like that, so that if you find one of these things, you're like, I know, if I follow this, I'll end up somewhere safe.
Interesting.
I kind of like that.
I like the idea that, like, they would call them, like, something like the Minoan roads or something.
Yeah. Or the safe paths or something like that, or that's cool. I could totally get behind that. And then they could really view that as a sort of, not just are they doing this to save people from the labyrinth, but also as, like, by doing this, they are maintaining the structural integrity of the world around them, you know, which makes them sort of like a guard or a warder, or maybe even somebody who builds walls to keep the labyrinth at bay. Would they be the kind of people who would not have doors? Because, like, we were talking about how you might just open a door and, like,
a
labyrinth on the other side. So, like, instead they, like, favor like curtains or the kind of passageway where you have to, like, go in and around and back in, so you still can't see through, but, like, by preventing the actual, you know, like, closing of a door, it, like, gives it one less place for the labyrinth to appear. Or maybe they just very much, like, favor architecture that's open plan, where they don't have interior walls, so that everybody can see each other and you don't get closed off. That maybe that's one of the things, is they have, like, maybe they build in some of the ways to keep yourself safe in the labyrinth sort of built into their culture. Like, literally the buddy system, like if you aren't going anywhere, you should go with somebody else, because it's harder if there's two of you for one of you to end up lost. And you have to keep, like, and also if you keep somebody else in sight, then it is harder for them to turn into a Minotaur, right? Like, because you maintain, you're like, no, that is the person I know. And if you look away and look back, even if they appear as a monster, you're like, no, that is my friend. And you can like maintain that sort of, like, groundingness into knowing who they are.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. So another thing that's kind of interesting, or I'm curious about, I should say, is does, like, the gateway to the labyrinth happen, like, on the first offense, basically? Like, is it just accepted that this is, or do you have to sort of, like, build up to, you know, being someone who turns them away or betrays the guest right?
I think the degree to which so how strong the connection between wherever you are and the labyrinth is decreases the amount of a crime you have to commit. So, like, if your entire country has been really lax about these laws, then it can get to the point where the first offense of even just, like, you know, turning somebody away at the wrong time could land you deep in the labyrinth.
I'm picturing a situation where, like, there's this plague that we mentioned going on, and, you know, there's someone just, like, running down the streets searching for shelter and just banging on doors and being turned away, and one by one, like, the city just falls into the labyrinth.
Exactly. Yeah. So like, it's one of those things where if the people who we are talking about who are like very strongly associated with it and are trying their best to keep the labyrinth at bay, if they're doing a good job, then you have to be really egregious in order to end up there. But if your whole country is sort of teetering on the edge and has been doing this for a while, then like, yeah, I love the idea that like, there might not be anybody to take you in because they're all literally already gone, you know? That's cool. In that sense, the way we've talked about it, the labyrinth seems like more of a danger to the people who are in the houses than the person outside.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there a manifestation of it where it shows up in the outside world? Like if you're walking down a city street or out in the forest where there aren't any doorways, like how do you end up there? Do you end up there?
I was thinking like maybe the path I was going to pursue is what happens if a guest violates like the guest right.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything there that spawns a portal to the labyrinth, or
maybe there's an antithetical labyrinth. Maybe there's the other version of it, the emptiness or something, where like instead of it being closed off, it's the guest version, right? Like maybe there's the version that's for the people who are out in the world, and maybe it's not like, you know, it's not the heaven to your hell, right? Like it's just the other side of the same coin. Like it's made of the same stuff, but it manifests in a different way, where instead of it being like an endless maze, it's an endless nothing or something.
Interesting.
And then, but I like the same idea that like or even just like an endless forest or something like that, like a misty dark forest that just goes on forever in every direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's impossible to find your way through. And that's where you could end up if you're out in the living world. Maybe that's the same. This is a different part of the same labyrinth, but just manifesting differently. And maybe that's where you end up if you are a bad guest, you know, if you overstay your welcome, if you take for granted other people's hospitality and don't thank them, for example, you know.
Or even more egregious, you steal from them or murder them after they've invited you in.
Yeah. Where you, the next time you leave a house, you just start wandering through the wilderness and you end up in this other part of the labyrinth, you know. And that puts you out on these, you know, empty exposed plains where there is no shelter. Like, I kind of like the idea that they get denied the thing that they took for granted the same way that the other people do, where like you took advantage of somebody else giving you shelter and keeping you safe, and now you find yourself in a place where that is not possible. You cannot find a place to be safe because there's just nothing.
I like that there's like these like direct like metaphysical punishments for these sins, and it kind of leads me to wonder like what other, like are there other sins like this, or is it just sort of this guest host relationship?
I definitely like this. If we're making a whole cosmology, then of course we would sit down and write up all the things that we think most important. I'm not sure if there's anything that leads directly off of what we're talking about, but I do like the idea that this is just some part of a larger system, you know, that like humanity, this is a version of humanity that's maintaining itself. This tiny little light of humanity and compassion and like civilization in this huge evil like expanse that exists in every other direction, you know, and that we're just sort of managing to maintain our little fire in the wilderness, you know, and it's only through banding together and treating each other right that like we are able to do that. And so like, in that sense, the things that you might find important, like all of the things that that might get rewarded in this system, are the ones which like allow humanity to sort of hold on to one another and like maintain a relationship with each other, rather than like we're not actually particularly care. We don't particularly care about maybe things like pride, because pride doesn't necessarily hurt or harm in this sense. Whereas like being proud of yourself, maybe that just makes you a good leader, you know, or maybe, you know, having pride, you know, it doesn't really make you, it doesn't isolate you the same way that it might else, that other things like, you know, refusing hospitality might. I'm not sure.
I do kind of like the idea that like maybe this world is almost a sort of purgatory, like,
sure,
which is why there's like such harsh punishments for failing to follow these rules or to be the good person that, like, You're kind of teetering on the brink of heaven and hell in this place.
I'm thinking maybe this is an after apocalypse.
Yeah.
This is a post-apocalyptic world, like literal apocalypse. Like the gods came down and rendered their judgment and took the righteous up to heaven and sent the unrighteous to hell.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And the people who are left are the people who weren't good enough or evil enough to have their judgment already and are just sort of like, the world is now one big test to see if you are, where you're going to end up.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. We're just, everybody's running out the clock, sort of, which is super bleak, but also gives you hope because you could, like, theoretically, like, now that you know that the test is on, you know, the your scores are being graded, then presumably enough, you know, many people would also find that as an ability to, like, move forward and become better people.
And we see that with these, you know, these evangelists of the labyrinth and, you know, of taking care of each other.
Yeah, yeah. You could see them as sort of like we're talking about them being guides, being lighthouses. Maybe they're actually like trying to guide people into heaven. They're like evangelists in the sense of like, we are going to show you the path in order to become a better person so that you can like not end up in hell. Like this is, you're going to be sent to whatever our version of heaven is. And that's what they're actually trying to do is hold out their hands to other people to let them climb up out of this purgatory.
And I like the idea that like maybe they've found the way, like,
yeah.
And like, but it's sort of a trap in a sense. Like if they just go themselves, like they're abandoning these people.
Oh. So
and it becomes like a selfish thing.
Maybe that's part of it where, one of the things that you need to cultivate within yourself is a desire to help others and to do so selflessly.
Yeah.
And so the people who are there guiding the way are the ones who are still sort of doing it selfishly. Like the moment when you like finally get it and like understand it is the point at which like, oh, okay, I would do this just because I want them to be helped. And it's very hard to do. So there's a fair number of people who are still working themselves towards that direction. And there's, in the meantime, they're still also doing, they happen to be doing good for the wrong reasons. Like they're doing it to get into heaven, but they are still doing good in the meantime, you know?
I feel like the ultimate test and sort of comes in like a moment of self-sacrifice somehow for just a selfless act that puts you at complete disadvantage.
Yes.
Maybe even the ultimate sacrifice, you know, to help these people.
Yeah, people who won't necessarily be grateful, you know, like you're not going to get anything out of it. You'll do something that will make the world less just because you'll die. But it was the right thing to do because you were going to be helping other people. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's a pretty complete cosmology we've ended up with out of this one idea.
Not a whole lot on the Minotaur, but I always love it when we go off on these little.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like. Because the turned out the more interesting thing was the labyrinth, which I think makes sense. That's a whole metaphor in and of itself about the real what was really, I don't know, like what's the heart of the story really?
Yeah,
is the labyrinth, not the Minotaur. I love it. Well, in that case, bye.
Until next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Monster Mechanics. Monster Mechanics is produced and edited by me, Scott Paladin, and hosted by myself and my best friend, Zach Jakeways. All of the ideas generated during this podcast are released under a Do What the F*** You Want public license.